Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, and it's a big one. We've got to the end of the road to Qatar, hastily constructed and partially unfinished as it may be. And here's part one of a two-part tactics-focused preview of the World Cup. I'm Ali Maxwell. Like many of the teams we'll be discussing in due course, we've gone three at the back for this tournament. Mark Carey brings height, composure, and an incredible knowledge of the exact scoring probability from every square foot of the penalty box. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for that intro. I like that one.
Wow, we've got Liam Tharm on the other side of the three. He reads the game well. He wants to be on the front foot, engaging with play, a part of the new generation at Liam's first major tournament. How are you doing, mate?
I'm well, thank you. How are you, Ali?
I'm really well. Excited. In the middle of it, Michael Cox, veteran of several World Cups, our sweeper, our Fabio Cannavaro. Hello, my friend.
Yeah, I don't have the pace to cover the wide areas, but mop up behind Mark and Liam.
But if we win the thing, you'll be the front runner for the Golden Ball, just because it's mainly a narrative award, isn't it, these days?
Yeah, I'll take that, yeah.
Regardless of how you play. I'd say the star, as we hit record of the four, has to be Liam Tharm, because Liam's released some of the best bits of written content I think I've ever read, with eight tactical group previews for the World Cup. Liam, that wasn't done overnight.
No, 3 months or so to be precise. I've obviously got the support of a very good team that helped me out a lot. I can't take pure credit for it, and I'm sure the Opta email people as well have been bombarding with requests. Funny, please to have a clear inbox. But no, it's, I think, really good fun. Such a variety of teams as we're going to go on and cover. Obviously, a World Cup that is going to look very different and a lot of tactical repercussions. So I think it's really exciting.
I actually thought you were doing a bit there when you were thanking the team behind you. I thought you were pretending to be a player that had won an award. Then I realised you're being sincere. That's lovely. That's absolutely lovely. Mark, you've been working hard as well on some World Cup preview content, but it's quite secretive.
It is quite secretive. All will be revealed on Friday. Mm-hmm. We have something very exciting, a very thorough look at a lot of players who are playing in the World Cup. So without giving away the title, I've pretty much given everything away but that. But I'm still going to be drip feeding some of the information that I have been working on in this time throughout this podcast.
So. Smells like pizza charts to me. Michael, we're expecting big things from you over the next few weeks. I think, you know, broadly, as I say, a veteran of many major tournaments as a tactics writer, we know what to expect. How are you feeling ahead of the tournament?
Yeah, looking forward to it. I'm there for most of the group stages, going out on Tuesday, and a wide variety of games I'm doing. A lot of the African sides I'm seeing and looking forward to covering them. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the World Cup. I must say, a week ago, I wasn't quite in the spirit while we still had Premier League games, but now it's mere days away. I'm well up for it.
Absolutely. Well, what will The Athletic be offering during the tournament? Tons of in-depth content, as you can imagine, on every game, every team, every footballing moment that matters, analysis, news, at long reads as well, Michael and Liam and Mark, but so many others as well, working together to provide the best football coverage available, but also plenty of reporting on key stories off the pitch as well, on Qatar as the host nation. Questions of human rights, of infrastructure, of politics will be covered by The Athletic as well. So make sure that you're checking the site for all of your Qatar 2022 needs. We are going to be talking football tactics, and most previews will start with Group A and go through it alphabetically, but we're not most previews. We want to start with energy and with passion. So I asked the guys what they think are the most interesting groups tactically, what's their favourite, and that's where we'll start. Age before beauty, Michael to pick first. What's the best World Cup group?
I'm up for Group H. I think it's got a wide variety of teams from different continents, different styles, a couple of interesting kind of situations with individuals against countries they know about. So, yeah, Group H is the last, but definitely not the least.
Is analysing all of these teams, many of which play in completely different and very, very different looking and feeling continental qualifying stages and continental tournaments, and working out how, when two teams from different continents take the pitch together, their different approaches, that the different makeup of those teams will mix. Is that where you look back at previous World Cups and try and work out trends almost?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the strength of the World Cup, and I think that's the strength of football as well. I mean, there's not that many sports that are played so globally like football, and therefore you have such massive regional variations or global variations. It's maybe not as much difference as there used to be 20, 30 years ago. But yeah, a clash of styles is really what you're looking for, and I think Liam covered that well in his previews.
Yeah, Liam, you've been watching, you know, Gold Cup games, you've been watching Asia Cup games. No doubt while you're watching those, you're seeing little patterns that you like from certain teams or weaknesses that you see from other teams. How did you work out when you mixed it all together, you know, what's ultimately going to be important, what's going to be effective in Qatar?
I think, as Michael said, you need to be sensitive to the intricacies of different teams and sort of different regions. A lot of that extends to when you're looking at CONCACAF or perhaps at some of the Asian qualifying, that, you know, team quality comes into play. So if we're going to look at certain teams, take Japan or sort of South Korea, when they're playing, that their level of opposition that they play might be lesser compared to what they might face in the World Cup. So it's then sort of adapting, and I suppose that's really trying to put a bit of an analyst hat on to say what's the most relevant opposition. Often we then check back to, you know, recent major tournaments. Thankfully there's been one across every continent since the last World Cup, so we've got obviously Euros to fall back on last summer, Copa America, Asian Cup, etc., and the Gold Cup too. So they're really a good basis, I think, to look at teams in that regard.
But Mark, just focusing on previous World Cups for research purposes, I know that this is still ultimately a small sample size. You know, trying to find definitive answers and using that for predictions, you know, could have some pitfalls as well.
You know me very well that I've already brought up sample size. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's even hard to look at things from maybe the start of the qualification to the end, because it's just so much variation. You can have players who come in and out of the squad through injury, someone who's maybe had a really good run of form, and the sort of the disparity in how sparse the games are across the whole of the qualification phase means that to pick up any really reliable trends, which is why it's credit to Liam for doing it so well, is really difficult. So I'm not going to lean too much on data throughout this tournament. I'm just going to maybe look at some more descriptive statistics based on the game, because it's very difficult to find patterns.
And the fun thing about this, or one of the fun things, is this is the first World Cup since the introduction of the Nations League. And I think the Nations League is probably a better barometer than qualifying. Mm-hmm. By definition, qualifying is a lot of games against sides who aren't good enough to be here. But I mean, you look at the Netherlands, for example, all four of the sides in the Nations League are at this World Cup. And if they finish top of that group, it's probably a pretty good sign they're going to do well here.
And to build on that, we've actually seen a few clashes of, particularly on the UEFA side, teams that are facing each other in the World Cup actually play against each other in the Nations League. So France and Denmark are a great example of that. And I think it's interesting, we're normally used to teams preparing for opposition by playing maybe a similar team continentally. But now to see them play the same opposition within 6 months, 9 months, a year, I think adds another sort of level of insight to it.
And the majority of football fans who focus on the European leagues, the Premier League and others, are spending this week trying to read up and learn all about the teams, the sides that they know less about. There's some pitfalls there as well, because you like sort of quick fixes, quick answers, like Iran are the highest ranked Asian side in the tournament, and things like, well, Senegal are the African Cup of Nations champions, but they beat Egypt on penalties in the final, and Egypt beat Cameroon on penalties, I think, in the quarter final. So even using the simple fact of Senegal won it, Cameroon quarterfinals, therefore Senegal better than Cameroon, dangerous to do that.
Yeah, Euros is a good example of that. I mean, Italy won it. Beat England on penalties, they beat Spain on penalties. I mean, there was a whole branch of that tournament on penalties. And I dare say there'll be some penalty shootouts in this tournament too.
Oh, we quite liked the performance of Spain in the semi-final against Italy, and I wonder whether in our personal thinking that would have sort of boosted them in our minds and our rating of them higher than Italy, even though they won the thing. It's fascinating. Let's talk about some of these teams. in Group H, which Michael has selected as his most interesting group. I'm interested to know why that would be. We've got Portugal, Uruguay, Ghana, and South Korea. Is this interesting to you because of the mixture of the four? Because you think Portugal are a vulnerable big cheese, so to speak?
I think that comes into it. I mean, in terms of their starting 11, I think Portugal look really strong. They'll be really familiar, probably aside from England, the most familiar team to most Premier League watchers, probably even more so than Wales. But there are some tactical questions there. I mean, Fernando Santos is very cautious. We know that's brought success in terms of 2016, but when you look at the way they won it in 2016, again, wasn't that convincing. And there's a bit of, the Ronaldo debate that we've had over the last year or so at Manchester United, I think has started to creep in with Portugal as well. So I'm interested to see how they'll go. I wouldn't be surprised if they went deep into the tournament, but I don't think, I mean, of all the kind of favourites for the group, and they are the favourites for this group, I would be least surprised if they went out early, I think.
Interesting that, because they are one of the great on-paper teams of this tournament, right? Ridiculous talent in all areas. Incredible fullback options with Cancelo, with Bruno Mendes. Wide options and every different type of wide player as well, with the speed of Leao and Bernardo Silva's invention. Even in the midfield, such balance between William or Paiño of Fulham, the sort of destroyer types, with Neves, the passer, and Bruno Fernandes as well. It's an amazing team on paper, an amazing team to play with on FIFA, let's say, Liam. But they don't necessarily look like that under Fernando Santos, do they?
As Michael alluded to, there's been question marks over the tactics. He feels quite rigid in a 4-3-3 shape, which can be imbalanced as maybe the wrong word to use, or asymmetric. But on the left side, they've probably got more of an overlapper in Mendes at left back, and they've got Rafa Leao, who of course has had a really strong season so far, and maybe more of a dribbler. Compare that to Bruno Fernandes and Cancelo on the right. Obviously, at club level, we've seen Cancelo on the left. He plays at right back for Portugal. Two, I think, more technical players that like to combine, play 1-2s, combinations. And I think then working around that is where you can sort of fit in more talent. And I don't know how much Ronaldo really benefits them as a team. When you've got good technical players, you don't really need a number nine that's going to drop in and sort of play passes and link play. You've got enough good midfielders, so I'm not entirely sure he benefits them in that way. Of course, he scores goals. This is a debate we could probably have for hours and hours. But I just think there's a great quote from Fernando Santos in September after the Nations League win, where he says, "I have one trophy left to win. The best is yet to come, and it will come this year." So he's obviously very confident in his team and in his selection, even though their Euro exit last summer was their earliest they'd ever left the European Championship. So,
Michael, we spoke last week. Teams don't have to look fluid, exciting, particularly coherent to win major international tournaments. What is it about Portugal that makes you think it's not just that they don't look as good as they so maybe should do, but actually they might genuinely struggle?
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily that I fancy them to go out, but I just think there's a few unanswered questions about the team and the shape, and they probably won't concede many goals, but I just don't think they'll score that many, considering the kind of attacking options they have. I don't know whether you're into omens and this kind of thing, but there's been three World Cups this century where Portugal haven't done well: 2002, 2014, 2018. Their last opponents in each of those tournaments were South Korea, Ghana, and Uruguay.
Wow.
And they're the three teams they're up against here.
That's unbelievable, isn't it? Which of those three do you think's best placed to beat Portugal, go on and win the group? Uruguay getting a lot of mentions in the always popular dark horse debate. I've got a bit of a twinkle in my eye for South Korea.
I mean, I would still go for Uruguay. I think there's a few question marks about them. I'm not quite sure they're just built to go long in tournaments as they have been in the past. But yeah, Korea, interesting team. Liam, you might have some good tactical insight on them.
What's quite cool about them is their manager, Paulo Bento, is Portuguese and played for Portugal against South Korea. I think it was World Cup 2002, and spoke quite openly that he didn't want to draw Portugal when the draw came out, obviously with his allegiances. So I think that will be an interesting game to look at. Narrative-wise, they're probably quite similar in shape. They're more of a 4-2-3-1. Anyone that watches the Premier League will be quite aware of their wide players in Son Heung-min and Hwang Hee-chan. good license to roam, but they're quite, at least in qualifying, a high possession side. You know, very rigid double pivot that allows those players to roam. Not sure it gets the best out of Hwang or Son, who are good, you know, with spaces to break into and maybe counter-attacks at times, but there's definitely enough wide area quality there, I think, on both sides to hurt opposition.
Yeah, definitely got the sense from your preview, Liam, they're a good technical ball-playing team, and I wondered how, therefore, their match against Uruguay might look. It could be a crucial game to decide, let's say, who finishes second in the group. Uruguay no longer with Oscar Tavares in charge of them. There's almost like putting on an old pair of slippers when you're doing a tournament preview and you see Tavares, Uruguay manager, or Yogi Löw, of Germany manager, he's gone as well now. It's a little bit sad. Still a lot of the old guard there, though, Michael, just with a new name managing them. Diego Alonso, what's his approach?
Yeah, I think he's probably a bit more forward-thinking than Tabarez, who tended to be quite cautious and tended to kind of have the know-how to get through tournaments. I think their midfield is looking really good. I mean, with Bentancur and Valverde have both had fantastic seasons for Tottenham and Real Madrid, respectively, so far. I worry in certain positions about maybe a lack of pace. I think defensively, I don't know whether Diego Godin is going to start, but I find it extraordinary that he might start ahead of Arroyo.
He's one of the best defenders of the last 15 years.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And maybe international football is the kind of situation where those kind of old school defenders, penalty box defenders, can thrive. I'm more excited to see them than I have been about Uruguay for a while. I usually think they're quite efficient and quite effective and quite physical and aggressive, rather than being exciting. But I think with that midfield, with Pelestri on the right as well, they have got attacking talent. So and it should be fun to watch.
We talked about cycles last week. I can't work out whether Uruguay are in a fresh new cycle with a new manager and with this group of Bentancur, Araujo, Valverde, Nunez, of course, are recognisable names, all kind of 25 and under, but then also Suarez, Cavani, Caceres, Muslera and Godin, all 34 and above. It's like, do we decide that they're in a new generation, or are they in that awkward spot in between, which is always held up as being something of a concern for some reason?
I think it's a fair question. And I think part of the answer here is Uruguay is such a small country with such a small population that even when they get four or five great young players along, they just can't overhaul the whole side. They're always going to be kind of looking around for players to make up the numbers. And, you know, you've still got Luis Suarez there. You've still got Edison Cavani there. And a little bit like Godin, they might be the kind of players who actually at international level are still capable of thriving.
I'm just laughing at the idea of them having to make up the numbers, like the 24th and 25th guys being like someone who went to school with Caceres back in the day and maybe still works with his brother or something like that. Isn't it?
I mean, Caceres has got to be up there with making up the numbers. I mean, he's one of those players I'm never sure what club he's at. He's moved clubs about 20 times in his career. He's had three loan spells at Juventus. I think he's at LA Galaxy now. But he's one of those players you think of him as an international player rather than a club player, definitely.
Liam, Michael, I want to raise a tactical question. Uruguay have slow centre-backs, Godin. Michael's referenced it. We're going to talk about a few other teams later on. Belgium spring to mind. Quite old centre-backs, slow centre-backs. And instinctively, that's a negative. You're like, oh, they're a bit slow at the back, aren't they? I want to posit that being slow at the back isn't as big an issue for a potentially 5-6-7 game international tournament, and the way that these games may look compared to playing in the Champions League now, where all of the attacking players are unbelievably quick and so much of that game is predicated on moments of transition now. What do you make of that?
I kind of agree with you. My only worry would be when you look at their opponents in this group, Iñaki Williams is fast. Career have got a lot of speed. Ronaldo's still relatively quick. So I wonder whether it might be a slight issue. But yeah, in general, I agree. I mean, there's been definitely some centre-backs over the years that have kind of rolled back the years and produced a performance that they weren't quite capable of matching at club level. Cannavaro, I'd say, in 2006, actually quite a good example of that. I don't think he was a world-class player at club level anymore, but obviously in the World Cup was fantastic.
You watched so much international football for your pieces. Did you get a sense that this looks and feels so different to what we watch week in and week out?
Yes, I think there's a great quote from Jesse Marsh. We said about international football and domestic football being like almost two different sports. I agree with the points about, you know, the speed with the opposition that they'll face. I think what might benefit them is we're expecting to see a lot of teams sit deeper now. There's going to be a lot of fatigue for quite a lot of players and played an awful lot of minutes. So maybe games won't be too transitional. They might be more like some of the playoff games that we've seen where teams are defending more in the midfield third, not wanting to press too heavily. So that might benefit them there. I think the one really interesting thing they do tactically, and Michael mentioned about their double pivot with Bentancur and with Valverde, is when they're building up from goal kicks, often they'll drop one of them deeper and effectively make a back three with that central midfielder in the middle and then look to play forward that way. So maybe providing some cover there in that area.
Can I ask you, Liam, as well, from the research that you've done, have you noticed the difference in terms of the high line, or not as much of a high line in international football? Not necessarily just in talking about Uruguay, but have you noticed that you talk about the Manchester Cities and the Liverpools of this world playing that line essentially on the halfway line. Have you seen less of that in what you've seen at the international level?
I think so. I think most teams tend to sort of their generic shape, or what they'll more frequently do is defend sort of deeper down the pitch. And then there's times where they'll then look to spring a press if there's a bad pass, or often it's goal kicks and the ball goes back to the goalkeeper. They've got time to really set up a shape, be organised, but you're not seeing that sort of relentlessness. I know Michael's touched on this in previous pods about, you know, the areas where in international games might be won or lost more in terms of sort of at set pieces or moments of individual quality. I think individuals can still win you games a lot more at international level than they can maybe at club level because of that, not pressing as much.
Makes me think of what we spoke about last week, Michael, your suggestion that international football lags behind elite club football in terms of how it looks and the styles that thrive. We couldn't quite put a number of years on it though, and I wonder whether we might, maybe this will be the tournament where we start to see the modern elite football style start to break out into international tournaments. And if that is the case, maybe some of the more ambitious teams in terms of pressing, maybe some of the more ambitious teams in terms of what they're trying to do in possession could start to rise to the top.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think the pressing will probably come into play a lot more at this tournament than at the previous World Cups because, yeah, it does seem to be lagging a few years behind. I just wonder about the schedule. I wonder whether the players will be quite tired by the quarterfinal, semi-final stage. But let's wait and see.
What about Ghana, the lowest ranked of the 32 teams in the competition, the 61st in FIFA's world rankings? What are you expecting from them, Michael?
They're an interesting side. I've got a lot of affection for Ghana based upon 2010. I'm not sure about them. I must say, I think they've got a few problems. The goalkeeper, first-choice goalkeeper, Woollacott, is out injured. I think that's a big blow. Some of their results over the last couple of years have been questionable. AFCON last year, they lost to Comoros, which is, quite staggering.
Novel.
Really. Yeah, when you consider their opposition here. They've also got a funny situation in the squad where they've brought in a lot of players at the last minute. I mean, the big two names being Iñaki Williams up front and Lamptey at right back. So I wonder about the cohesion. And you also have this issue that I think you often have when you have an African side who's got a really good defensive midfielder for a kind of elite European club, and they almost don't know what role they should play for their country. You know, whether Thomas Partey should be doing what he does for Arsenal, kind of sitting deep, or whether you want him to push forward a bit more and dominate the game. They've certainly got some good players. I'm just not quite convinced that they have the cohesion there.
Especially at the international level as well. I've done a piece that's out today actually looking at the makeup of most of the squads within the tournament. And Ghana's squad, 13 players have 5 international caps or fewer. So you think about that sort of trade, it's a half, obviously, that you think about that trade-off of maybe youth, maybe experience and just being a good player in general. Maybe you don't need that cohesion as much. But to have that many players who don't have as much international experience at any level, never mind at the World Cup, that is obviously going to play a part in it. And also Ghana being the youngest, on average, the youngest squad of anyone in the tournament. So not too many positive things to say there, but we shall see.
I think their game against Nigeria, the qualifier, the playoff, I should say, was a great case study. It's a really big derby as well. I was speaking to Carl Anker about this, and you look at some of the numbers from those games, they were outperformed in terms of shots, but XG massively. They had 16 shots, Nigeria had 21, but the XG was 0.72 for Ghana against 2.48 for Nigeria, so giving up a lot of chances, needed the goalkeeper to bail them out at times, which can be okay in tournament football. You don't need to be a great underlying metrics team. It's a game of, you know, winning. You don't worry too much about what the numbers are trending, but And speaking to Carl and watching Ghana, there are worries in attack. They scored half the number of goals of Senegal in qualifying. They only scored 8. Morocco got 24, Cameroon 14, and Tunisia 11. So you look at the players they're bringing in now, and I think it's probably more of a necessity than a nice thing to have. These players might not just be coming in, but also coming in to be starters or really important players. These aren't players 24, 25, 26 in the squad.
I'll be interested to see who they go with in goal to replace Wallacott. Wallacott plays for Charlton Athletic in League One, was the best goalkeeper in League Two last season, England's fourth tier. Obviously, someone that I'm desperately sad for, having been ruled out just days before the start of the tournament, and it would have been an incredible thing. There are two other players in League One who are both in the Wales squad. There are two players in League Two also in the Wales squad. But you have to also think objectively, if your first choice goalkeeper is playing in League One and is unavailable, who will be filling the gloves, so to speak, and how much of an issue might that be in comparison with some of the teams in their group? Group E was our next best. Strongly fancied this by Liam and Mark. Mark, this one's Germany, Spain, Japan, Costa Rica. What do you like about this?
Well, I just think maybe it's because I've got my European hat and head on, but Germany and Spain, just two international powerhouses. It's just an easy one to catch your eye.
I agree. I think it's too easy to catch your eye.
Well, true. But I was going to say as well, I quite like the look of Japan. I think that it's sort of fair to say, and again, from reading Liam's piece, that Japan have got a lot of good forwards and not necessarily a good striker, a clinical striker, which you maybe need in the World Cup in such a short number of games played. But I do like the makeup of, you know, Kamada and Minamino, even though he's not always guaranteed to start the likes of them. I just think that they could be exciting going forward, creating a lot of chances, hopefully then putting them away as well. But Costa Rica as well, they are kind of much of a muchness a little bit. But I just think Germany, Spain and Japan, there could be maybe a surprise there for second place.
I think this is a really exciting group because I'd say it's really good in terms of attack and in possession. But ironically, there's not really one standout number nine that you'd expect to score, you know, a ton of goals. Spain, we know about their scoring issues, despite being, you know, one of the most aesthetic, effective teams to watch in build-up. The same thing for Germany. They have what feels about 400 good number 10s or attacking midfielders, but you know, not a huge sort of depth of options, at least in the number nine role. So I think they're, in particular, a good tactical clashes. Looking at Spain against Costa Rica, I think they play in their first game, you know, a real good sort of defensive block up against a high possession team. I think there's a few good sort of litmus tests for different teams in terms of how they can break down different opponents. And as Michael said at the start, you want that contrast in styles.
Feels like Costa Rica basically being written off, Michael, because of the strength of the teams in their group with them, that they made it through the group stages in 2014. And, you know, reading Liam's tactical preview, they do profile as a strong defensive low block and counter-attack side, which I guess at least is a good fit for the matches that they'll play, particularly against Spain and Germany.
Yeah, and they got a good manager. I mean, Luis Fernando Suarez came in and really turned around their qualification. He's coached Ecuador and Honduras at the tournament before. 2006 did very well with Ecuador, actually. I think they're going to be defensive, partly because that's their style and partly because, as Liam says, they're up against three sides who want to dominate possession. So I think we're going to see a lot of deep defending, maybe a switch to a back five at some point, and maybe use speed on the break. But yeah, we all, I mean, they were the least likely side to qualify in 2014 and they topped the group. So I don't want to write them off too much.
And Ali, what can you tell us about Jurson Bennett? Because he's looking like a real, slightly on the peripheries of the Costa Rica squad, but a real talent, a real good dynamic attacker. What do you make of him?
Yeah, definitely stands out just as being an 18-year-old Costa Rican attacking player who plays for Sunderland, having joined in the summer. He's made 9 fairly brief sub-appearances so far and scored 1 goal against Watford, which was very well taken, late equaliser. So he's been held back a little bit by Tony Mowbray, which, you know, it's not hard to imagine that he might just be being bedded in, shall we say. Big move at that age over to the UK. But, you know, one of the few but examples of something that we may see more over the next few years of championship clubs, no Premier League clubs have as well, but championship clubs actually looking to South America for their young talent in lieu of the European leagues that they now can't fish in because of Brexit and the GBE regulations. So Norwich have bought a few players from, well, one from Brazil and one Nunez from Chile, and Sunderland sort of showing the creative vision to go and get Burnett from Costa Rica as well. Hopefully we'll see some flashes of him, but the sort of games that they're going to be playing, you wonder if an 18-year-old wide man is going to be, particularly called upon. I want to talk about Japan, but first Germany and Spain, because it's easy to group them together. They are strong favourites to qualify from this group. They are international football powerhouses, recent winners of the World Cup. Michael, I want to differentiate between them, but I also feel like of the bigger teams in the competition, let's say the eight biggest names in the competition, they strike me tactically as also quite a similar profile, maybe the two most similar teams.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, they did feel quite different, Spanish football and German football. And I think German football's kind of moved towards Spanish football in being about possession, about technical players and the rest of it. They're an interesting side, Spain, because I'm not sure you'd necessarily look at their squad and pick out any player as being really world-class. But they've got a very talented squad. I think of all the teams in this competition, they probably know their system the best. It's going to be 4-3-3. They've got Busquets and Gavi and Pedri in the middle.
Not ready to call any of those names world-class? Gavi and Pedri, the youngsters, Busquets, the opposite?
Yeah, you're right. I guess those two young lads are emerging, but they're not kind of the established stars. I mean, usually, even before Spain's run of success, they'd always pitch up with someone like Raul, you know, and I'm not sure they have that go-to figure at the moment. But I do like, I mean, whenever I watch them, I'm more impressed than just by looking at their results, if that makes sense. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not, because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the semi-final against Italy, I think they were the better side in that game and ended up going out. So I think they'll progress relatively comfortably here.
They're going to dominate the ball against Costa Rica and against Japan. How do you think their game against Germany will look? Will both teams be after long spells of possession, or will Germany maybe revert to what's considered a more German approach, less possession hungry and more let's exploit Spain when we win it back?
It could be a really interesting clash tactically. I think you could almost see both sides lining up with a false nine. I think it was against Italy where Spain used Dani Olmo in the false nine at the Euros, and he's used Asensio similarly in the Nations League. So again, sort of trying to find those areas to exploit. It's going to be a massively important game in terms of the midfield. I know we'll touch on Germany a bit more, but we've got a very strong double pivot in Kimmich and Ilkay Gundogan. So there's so much quality in that midfield area. Something obviously has to give, but trying to predict that in advance, I think, is incredibly difficult. And you'd again expect sort of individual brilliance or perhaps a mistake to end up deciding that it's really close.
If both teams are expected to be excellent in possession and in an attacking sense, it feels like finishing is going to be the big difference between the two teams broadly, right? And there are probably question marks over both teams' number nines and how good they are when they get in the box at just being cold-blooded, deadly finishers. But equally, Michael, defensively will therefore be a huge separator as well. Germany, England, Euros in 2021 springs to mind. I realise there's a new manager in charge of Germany now, but they looked pretty vulnerable to England's attacks at times. Do you have question marks about them defensively?
To a certain extent, I think they defend differently now, as you say. I think they defend a bit higher up the pitch with Hansi Flick. I think there are some question marks there. I mean, Raum at left back is a good overlapper. I'm not sure about him defensively. Kehrer, if he's going to play right back, I haven't been that impressed with him since he came to the Premier League, I must be honest. So, yeah, I do think there are a few question marks there. But I also think Germany probably have the more efficient, effective forward players. I really like Havertz. I thought he was really good at the Euros as well before they got knocked out. And Leroy Sané is the kind of player who I'm kind of reassured when I see Germany or Spain playing a player like that, someone who's just going to run in behind and offer that directness. I really do think you need that at times.
I wonder if there's a more... If there's a stronger motivational thing than being the player who plays for one of the bigger nations that everyone highlights as being the weak link, right? So you just mentioned the fullbacks for Germany there. You made a noise before you said Kehrer or after Kehrer. He said it all. You know, he's clearly on paper the weak link. It made me think of Joan Capdevila of Spain.
But
imagine how motivating that would be to know that.
Thing is, I know what you mean because he was the only one who wasn't at Real or Barca. But was he ever really called the weak link?
Yeah,
I don't think he was. I think people were just like, well, he doesn't play for Real or Barca. But he was not a, he was very solid, Captivia. I mean, more solid than these two fullbacks, in my opinion.
Okay.
I'd build on that with Michael's point, actually, to not taking sides, but I'll defer Michael on this. I've not been hugely impressed with Tulo Kehrer this season. I think he's normally a centre-back that's sort of pushed out wide. Realm's great going forward. I know his attacking numbers are excellent, but again, I think they've had big issues defending wide areas and crosses in particular. You look at Luke Shaw's goal for England in the Nations League. It comes from across on one side, from the right, and then Shaw, obviously, England's fullback, ends up getting in there to score. So they might end up falling back a bit on Neuer, who, of course, is an exceptional shot-stopper. We know good his sweeper keeping is, etc. So again, another big name and someone that can definitely bail them out, so that might be okay enough to, you know, be weak in those areas, but you've got a good enough goalkeeper. And I think it's just great to see Mario Götze back as well, of course, scorer of a World Cup winning goal. Great to see him back. Not sure how much of a role he'll play, but definitely adds to the romance, I think, of this tournament.
Mark, this is the group to be watching if you like wonder kids, to use a broad term. Big things expected of Jamal Musiala. Mukoku's there as well with Germany. 17, is he? Pedri and Gavi, as we've discussed, and Jewison Bennett as well of Costa Rica.
Yeah, well, I think I've spoken enough on this podcast about Jamal Musiala. I just love the way that he plays. I think he's got 17 international caps already, and he's not even 20 yet. So it shows just how much trust he's been given to play at the international level. Just keeps exceeding expectations. I think I'm right in saying that this is Mukoku isn't internationally capped at the senior level, so it shows just how exciting he could be as a, not even a lesser known player, because he's just so hyped at the moment, but just could be a really good sort of breakout tournament for him. So that's really exciting. I think we've spoken enough as well about Pedri and Gavi, just such exciting players. Two players that we profile within the said exciting list of players coming out on Friday, which does also include Mukoku and Musiala. So, yeah, I've watched enough of all of these players to know that they are not just good young players, they are very good players, to give them the biggest compliment, I think.
I wonder if Theo Walcott's reached out to Mukoku and just lent him something to lean on, you know, someone who's been in that position before, going to a major tournament at such a young age with plenty of hype. At Japan, Michael, I read Liam's preview and I just felt something. I can't explain it, I can't describe it. I felt something, and I think Japan will spring a surprise here. I think certainly avoiding defeat against one or both of Germany and Spain. And I actually think I think Germany or Spain might be one of the teams, and there's always one, that crashes out, but I can't choose who. Am I crazy to think Japan might have something about them?
No, I mean, they're not a side I've seen much of, to be honest. They're one of those sides that I'm kind of reading about rather than going on my own experiences of watching them. And the more you do read about them from people who know what they're talking about, maybe they have got something about them. I mean, there's no real stars there, which is unusual. They've usually had a Nakata or a Honda or a Kagawa, and they don't really anymore. And it's a big turnover. I mean, I think there's only two sides from the starters of 2018 who are still in this side. But by all accounts, they do sound well organised. They're good technically. Maybe don't score enough goals, but if they control the game by keeping the possession and don't concede many, maybe they'll spring a surprise.
I mean, something you said made me want to get behind them. I think it was the incredible group of attacking wide players. Now, some people would say, Ali, you can only really fit two of those in a team at any given time. But I say they're going to cause problems.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure they can fit all six in there. But Moriyasu did actually make an interesting tweak. He played 4-3-3 a lot during qualifying and switched to a 4-2-3-1 against the USA. They pressed phenomenally well
in a
4-4-2. It is, yeah, it worked really well. And to quote him, actually, he said, we used Endo, which is Endo Ito, Morita and Kamada, so Daichi Kamada, in the 4-2-3-1 system to see how we could bring the best out of each individual player, which just, you know, suits the roles really and the styles of these players. That is without the likes of Takumi Minamino, who, you know, we know from his days at Liverpool. A lot of similar profiles of players who I think are really good technically, neat players in sort of tight pockets. And you could really sort of take your pick, really, as who goes where. It doesn't feel like it's tied down massively to a system. I think Kubo in particular is really exciting out wide. And they often play with, we're quite used to wingers being inverted now, I think, and dribbling inside. Often they play with a left footer on the left and a right footer on the right. So they might be a bit different in that regard, not always getting the fullbacks into advanced positions. But a really exciting team. And any of our US listeners will know how good they were in that friendly in September. And I'd urge anyone to go back and watch that first half, because they were just phenomenally good without the ball.
maybe the big question mark being the number nine position. But then I'm pretty sure we've said the same about Spain and Germany. So maybe that cancels it, all cancels each other out. That's been Group E. Next up, after a short break, we'll be talking Group G, which contains the favourites, Brazil.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Gabriel Jesus dominou na boa. Que bolão, Neymar. Olha o gol, gol do Brasil. Neymar.
Michael, Group G contains the favourites, Brazil, and two certified dark horses in Serbia and Switzerland. You basically have to pick one between the two. And then Cameroon, who might even be being a little bit slept on as another potential dark horse. The favourites and three dark horses, Michael. I'm calling this the group of life.
Yeah, it's an interesting group. I think, as you imply, Brazil will almost certainly go through. People are being very positive about Brazil, and I understand why. But I think it's worth pointing out, Brazil have gone into every World Cup since they won it as the favourites. And so it's not like they've never turned up at a World Cup, you know, being strongly fancied. They've just tended to have one game, or often one half, really, where it all collapses. But I do think they are probably looking as strong as they have for 20 years. They've got a very good manager in Tite. They've got more attacking options than they have for more than a decade, without question. And they do seem to have great understanding between players as well. And I think that's obviously the thing that a lot of the other sides and a lot of the other favourites in this competition lacking. And you look at someone like Paquetá, who's done very well since he came to the Premier League, and it's not about what he's doing individually. I think it's about how he combines with Neymar, his understanding with Neymar, his recognition that his role is just to bring the best out of Neymar. So I'm interested to see them. I think they've got a couple of variations in how they play. I feel like they might start off quite bold with Rafinha and Vinicius out wide and Neymar and Paquetá, and then maybe do what Brazil often do in tournaments, which is bring in an extra central midfielder, holding midfielder midway through. But yeah, they've got they have got a look, almost a kind of serious look about them this time around.
Are they going to be as exciting and as attacking as I want them to be, Liam?
I think so. I think this is a team that's better than previous iterations of Brazil, particularly in the forward department. I think they've been a bit too reliant on Neymar at previous tournaments. Now they've got good, better forwards around him. They often play with Vinicius Jr. Or Paqueta off the left, Rafinha on the right, and those are players who unlike some other teams, you know, play inverted, so they'll come inside, and they're very good at sort of playing that final pass. That I think Neymar was their top scorer in qualifying with 8 goals, and they scored 40, which was comfortably the most of any South American team. But when you just see how much those goals are spread out, just shows all the attacking talent they've got. They had a couple of great goals against Tunisia, albeit in a friendly, but you know, up against a real set defence where Rafinha and I think Casemiro plays the assist for the first one, but these great incisive passes, able to pick lock even the most sort of well-organised defence. So they're really, really exciting going forward.
Some possession-heavy football, Michael, particularly for international teams who don't spend weeks and months training together all the time, can look quite stale, a bit automated almost. And it's almost like it lacks invention as the sort of thing to unlock defences at international tournaments. Brazil certainly seemed like the team with the most sort of flair and invention to unlock teams that are going to just sit in and try and nick a 0-0.
You're right. And they've got Neymar, who I think at the start of this season in European club football has been playing as well as anyone, really. And I think Liam's absolutely right. They've almost got the right balance where they're not dependent on Neymar. And yet I think he does dominate the side. And there is an understanding that he's the one you got to, you know, get the best out of. I mean, it's been interesting watching him play. He's got a lot of license to come deep. I mean, sometimes Brazilians are talking about him almost like he's a midfielder as much as a forward. So that's interesting. Maybe the one question mark is up front. I mean, that's been the area that's let them down in the past. You think of Fred in 2014, and Gabriel Jesus had a difficult time of it 4 years ago. It looks like it's going to be Richarlison to lead the line, but they've got so many attacking options. I mean, they've got Jesus, they've got Martinelli, they've got out wide Antony and Rodrigo. Firmino couldn't even get in the squad despite, you know, a really good start to the campaign. And that just wouldn't have happened in 2014, for example, when they were struggling for attacking options. So they do look quite fearsome. And a good defence as well. I mean, 17 games in qualifying, conceded 5 goals. That's really, in South America, that's impressive, because you don't really play any mugs in South America.
I think as well, when you list those players, that if you're thinking about teams, if they're going to think of Brazil as a massive threat like they are, that if you're going to sit off against them, you need some one-on-one, some players who are good in the one-on-one. You think about Rafinha, you think about Martinelli, Vinicius Jr., players who are going to commit players or at least drag players towards them. That's not even mentioning Neymar, who, as you say, will drop deep. But those players in those wide areas are going to be so threatening to at least shift and move the opposition around to open up space for others against the set defence, which, again, at international level is even more crucial. So it seems like whichever way you try to defend against Brazil, they'll have a different answer for it because of that flair.
I wonder if they'll have some good set-piece threat as well, because it's not hard to imagine they might be taking a lot of attacking free kicks from wide areas with the sort of 1v1 skill that they have. And as Mark says, you can't double or triple team one of the Brazilian players, because you really need to do that for two or three, and those numbers don't work. So, you know, if you're the defender and Rafinha skips past you, you might as well bring him down, because otherwise the whole deck of cards is going to come falling down. I guess the issue for Brazil, as far as I see it, Michael, is they're in a tough group. Serbia and Switzerland, I want to do together, because both European qualify teams, they play quite differently. They have a game against each other in match day 3, which could be absolutely huge. Serbia, Switzerland, weigh those two up for me and how you compare them.
I'm not sold on Serbia, I got to say. I think they concede too many goals. You look at their qualification record, 1 clean sheet in 8. Nations League B they were in, and only 2 clean sheets in 6. They've got fantastic attacking options, no question about that. I mean, Vlahovic might not get into the side, but they could play Vlahovic and Mitrovic with Tadic just behind, which is really exciting. And I like Kostic as well. He played brilliantly for Juventus against, who was that? I saw him against, was it Inter a couple of weeks ago? He was fantastic down the left. But yeah, just the goals conceded record gives me some cause for concern about Serbia.
Not hard to see how they could hurt teams, Liam, with, you know, Tadic and his inventiveness. But even if it's just Kostic spamming crosses into Mitro, that's enough of a threat. I think we see that in the Premier League now.
Oh, absolutely. They're my big shout for dark horses, so maybe Michael and I will be divided on this one.
Nice.
I think there's so much attacking talent and quality, and I think there's I know there's attacking quality elsewhere in the group, and what stands out to me really is that there's three of these sides that are likely to use a number 10, so it's interesting to see how they attack and defend against that. We'll probably see Neymar in the 10 for Brazil. Tadic, of course, we've seen him do this in the Premier League, and he's really good for Serbia because the forwards suit him ultimately. He's got Mitrovic, who likes to be a penalty box forward. Dusan Vlahovic likes to make those runs in behind. I think the beauty there is having two really different number nines that can play together as well. You can create so many different sorts of goals. They were the top team in terms of direct attacks in UEFA qualifying, which are sequences starting in the team's own half that very quickly progress to the other end of the pitch. So akin to sort of a counter-attack from deep. They hurt teams in sort of numerous different ways. And for me, obviously with them not being at the Euros last summer, I think people might quite quickly overlook them. But I think they're really, really talented.
Switzerland team... less chaotic, maybe more on the sort of cooler side of the pillow, well organized, excellent defensively, Michael, not leaping off the page as much in an attacking sense, but maybe that's on balance for the best in international tournament.
Yeah, I generally quite like Switzerland. They're usually solid, well organized, good quality out wide. Rodriguez still going at left back. Shaqiri tends to turn it on at international tournaments. I think they've got actually, there's a couple of really good goalkeepers in this group. I like Sommer a lot. I think he's generally done well. And also, we're going to speak about Cameroon in a second, I imagine. But Onana's a great goalkeeper as well. I'd back Switzerland over Serbia, I must say, just because of the defensive record. There have been some question marks about Xhaka and precisely his role in this side, which is maybe unusual considering how well he's been doing for Arsenal recently. Maybe a little bit like what I said about Thomas Partey earlier. But yeah, look at their qualification record, 2 goals conceded in 8 games. And that's the kind of thing I like when I'm, you know, working out which side I think we'll get through.
Well, maybe we're focusing so much on Serbia and Switzerland that we're taking our eye off Cameroon. Could they sneak in and cause an upset, Liam? I got the sense that having lost on penalties to Egypt in AFCON, up to that point, easy to say it, but up to that point had arguably looked like one of the strongest teams in the competition. So maybe we shouldn't just look at an early exit and consider them to be significantly weaker than, say, Senegal.
I mean, they were joint top scorers at the tournament, despite not going all the way through to the final. They scored 14, including their penalties. And I think they've got, like a lot of teams in this group, some real quality, talented attackers. Aboubakar, their sort of standout number nine, is a really versatile, balanced forward. I think he scored with his left foot, right foot and his head at AFCON, which is quite impressive to do in such a small number of games. And he had the most goals, I think, at an AFCON in the 21st century. Often playing off the left alongside him is Karl Toko Ekambi, who much more of a dribbler, a ball carrier, but again, these complementary attack pairings where you've got players that can do different things, can hurt teams in different ways. Again, I'm not entirely sold on them defensively. I don't think they're a great possession team either. They're at their best really when they can get the ball forward early, play crosses in from those wide areas, but a real good sort of attacking Arsenal, if you like, and that's without mentioning Chippy Moteng, who seems to come alive for Cameroon as well.
Well, I think that's my favourite group, to be honest. I think interest all over. Potential for quite a lot of goals, considering we're talking about Cameroon and Serbia in particular being potentially questionable at the back, and Brazil being, well, just having one of the most stacked attacking units that we've ever seen. It's going to be fascinating. That's for sure. Group A finishes off part one of the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast World Cup 2022 preview. Where does the interest lie for you in Group A, Michael? Netherlands, Senegal, Ecuador and Qatar.
I'm really looking forward to watching the Netherlands play, actually. I've always got a bit of a soft spot for them. I've got a huge soft spot.
Ooh, tactics.
Yeah, they love a bit of it, don't they? And I love Louis van Gaal. I've loved him throughout his career. The interesting thing about van Gaal is that for someone who kind of helped to revolutionise the game in terms of possession play in 4-3-3, actually, international level, he goes completely the other way. And it's a very similar approach to what they're doing in 2014. Five at the back, really, albeit with wing backs that compress, as Liam said in his preview. I'm probably going to play a little bit on the break. You know, Depay maybe playing the role that Robin did 8 years ago. Gakpo is one of the kind of emerging forces. There's a couple of interesting things about them tactically, you'll be pleased to know, Ali. I mean, at the back, it could be that De Ligt doesn't play because they quite like playing, or Van Gaal likes playing Timber and Ake wide, which means Van Dijk plays as the spare man in the middle. So I think that's quite interesting. And I just like their results. I mean, as I said earlier about the Nations League, they were in a four-team group with four teams or three other teams who are all at this tournament. Mm-hmm. And they had the best record in the entire competition. I think that bodes really well. Having not been at the tournament 4 years ago and been disappointing last year, I think it's fair to say, at the Euros, I'm really looking forward to watching the Netherlands.
Liam, tactically, they seem to me to be one of the more expansive and ambitious teams in the tournament. I think we're always applaud that because there are many teams who like to sort of keep the margins as small and as low as possible. You know, we're talking about a broadly a 3-4-1-2 formation, but is this the sort of team where we could probably press pause as they're on the attack? We might see a very clear sort of front five, the wing backs in particular, very attack minded.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I think Van Gaal made that switch from, I think it was a 4-3-3 initially, and lots of people, I think, massively misconstrued Van Dijk's comments about the sort of defence he likes to play in. And again, it's just to fit in those better players. You know, you get Frankie de Jong and Tian Koopmeiners, I think, in the middle were two really, really outstanding. De Jong in particular, you know, ball players can receive from the goalkeeper and either pass forward or drive
forward.
Do
not press those guys.
Absolutely not. Not that many teams will, but yeah, I think there's definitely no incentive to press them. And there's talent all over the pitch, and there's young talent now as well. Again, Michael's mentioned Cody Gakpo, who feels like quite a modern number 10, I think, in the sense that he's not particularly slight. He's very big, quite a physical presence, plays off the left a lot for PSV, scores goals, makes goals, scores different types of goals. He was excellent against Arsenal in the Europa League in particular this season, and I think was second at one point to Erling Haaland in terms of goal involvement sort of across Europe's major leagues, which I think for anyone to keep pace with him is pretty outstanding. And then to have that form going into your first World Cup is phenomenally good.
Be interested to see if they're at the start of a cycle, they're in a good spot in a cycle. It's quite hard to work out at the moment. I'm really looking forward to seeing this team in the flesh. And of course, if worst comes to worst, Michael, they got big Weghorst to chuck it in the mixer at if necessary. Those players, I mean, I'm sort of making a joke about it. Those players, you know, good to have in your squad in competition football.
They are, absolutely, and he was effective at the Euros last year. And you're right, he's not going to start this time, I don't think. But as a plan B, he's perfect.
I'd add Luke de Jong to that list as well, because he's called up another. So, you know, whether he brings both of them on, I'd be surprised. But there's definitely that option off the bench as far as Netherlands are concerned.
Senegal, Ecuador, Qatar finish off the group. Michael, are Senegal quite clearly the second strongest team in the group?
I think they would be if they had Mane. It looks like he's going to be absent from the opener, which will, of course, is against the Netherlands. And I do worry about that. I don't think there's many teams in this competition where you look at them and say, without the star player, they'll be, you know, weakened as much as Senegal would. That said, they are a good unit. I mean, they've got good tournament pedigree. They won the AFCON, and that shows they know what they're doing. They're very unlucky to go out at the group stage 4 years ago. If you remember, they went out on fair play points behind Japan, which is just an excruciating way to go out. And I mean, they're disciplined, they're tactically flexible. Aliou Cisse has switched at times to five at the back. And to me, they just seem more settled than a lot of the other African nations, a lot of whom have either got new managers or they've brought in quite a lot of players at the, you know, at the last minute who've only just declared for those countries. Whereas Senegal is a familiar 11. Cisse's been there since 2015. Cisse was, of course, the captain 20 years ago when Senegal beat France and got to the quarterfinals. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be positive about. I just hope that Mane is... I mean, if they lose to the Netherlands, it's hardly the end of the world. But if Mane is back against the other two sides, I think it makes them a completely different proposition.
They're also quite interesting in massively being a second-half team. They tended to start games quite slowly at AFCON. 8 of their 9 goals came in the second half and really came alive late on in games. So I think that's a massively beneficial thing at tournament football, where, you know, games might be hanging in the balance, and to be able to turn it on, admittedly that might be down to the likes of Mane, but Sarr, who often plays on the opposite flank, I think is equally talented. So, you know, seeing them possibly turn games around or have a late say will be really interesting.
Cisse was, as you mentioned, part of that wonderful Senegal team in 2002, Michael. In fact, he got a four-year Premier League career off the back of it. I was revisiting his career as part of my research. Very easily distracted I am. I was meant to be focused, but instead I was on Aliou Cisse's wiki page. And the year before the 2002 World Cup, he was on loan at Montpellier from PSG. So PSG obviously didn't fancy him that much. He certainly wasn't, you know, a player that they were too bothered having in the building. He played 17 league games for Montpellier that season and then went to the World Cup, of course, captained them to glory, and then got 2 years at Birmingham and 2 years at Portsmouth off the back of it. Steve Bruce saying, yeah, I've seen enough. Come and join the Blues. And he was very, very popular there, certainly in his first season as well. But it's just quite a funny one to look back on. He only played, per wiki, not my favourite source, 153 league games in his whole career, broadly averaging about 12 games a season over a career. 20% of his total career appearances came for Senegal. And now managing them magnificently, I have to say, particularly defensively. I've definitely got my eye on Senegal as a team who could, you know, if you play around with the bracket and the predictors, there's a few little ways where they could have a slightly kinder second round and quarter final than some of the sort of projected second placed finishers. But what about Ecuador manager Gustavo Alfaro in charge, Liam? A little 4-3-3 action. Are they a proactive team, a reactive team? What will we expect?
They're quite balanced. I mean, they're ultimately my second nation as a Brighton fan now, because it feels like half the Brighton side is Ecuadorian. But a very talented new sort of emerging young generation. The youngest team, I believe, in South American World Cup qualifying. So to qualify up against, as we've mentioned, we'll come on to Argentina at some point. But Brazil as well, having these, you know, real star-sided teams in really good form, to compete and to qualify against them, I think is really, really impressive. You mentioned the 4-3-3. They tend to stick to that quite a lot. They're quite a dynamic team. They've got good wide players, good quick wide players. Gonzalo Plata really stands out. They're not really a massively high possession team, not really a huge pressing team. They're probably quite good at a lot of things, like maybe being great or particularly exceptional, which I guess helps you through qualifying, but maybe means you struggle a bit more at the tournament itself. I think it's worth noting they play Senegal in the final group game, and I think that could really be a massive shootout for the second spot. And one player to watch for me really is 20-year-old Piero Hincapié, who plays, I believe, at Bayer Leverkusen. Very good, very technical, progressive centre-back, but also, you know, does things that I think people who like old-school centre-backs, you know, will head you in a goal. Very good box defender. I think he's quite well-rounded, and, you know, have a good tournament here. Who knows where he might end up?
Not a team that's actually won that many football matches, though, I noted. I think it was 3 draws in the Copa America, and in qualification, 18 games, and they only won 7 of them. So well under half of their games were won. What about Qatar? I am fascinated and a bit befuddled about Qatar, and I really don't know what to expect, because they've had the sort of preparation that only a host nation can have, and they've certainly taken it incredibly seriously. A 6-month-long training camp, including friendlies against a lot of different nations, domestic clubs. They lost to Croatia under 23s. Michael, they got a Spanish coach in Felix Sanchez Bass, and a couple of players flagged up by Liam in their preview. I cannot work out whether they are going to be competitive and do the home fans proud, or get absolutely battered.
Yeah, I think people would be surprised that they actually play good football, but I'm not sure that's conducive to success when you're the underdog in a group. I think they're going to want to play relatively open games, and I fear for their defence in that kind of situation. I mean, they do have a pretty regular starting 11. By all accounts, they've got 2 decent players up front. I don't know if Mark or Liam might be able to say a little bit more about them. I mean, they won the 2019 Asian Cup, and I think that is worth bearing in mind. I mean, they beat Japan and they beat South Korea on the way to winning that tournament. So they've clearly got something about them. I just not sure they'll find the right balance between, look, they've clearly tried to move forward in a very kind of progressive way, footballing wise, over the last 10 years. But when it comes to playing, you know, a side like Ecuador, who are, you know, physical and they're kind of battle ready and used to playing against top sides, I just think they could come unstuck.
I think that's totally fair. In terms of the 2 stand-up players, Akram Afif off the left is he's a good left winger. He's right-footed, so he likes to come inside. Afif had 10 assists in the 2019 Asia Cup, which Michael mentioned that they won. Often he was setting up Amoez Ali, who was their number 9. Really sort of good pairing and attacking pairing. Again, they'll be very reliant on that to get anything out of games. They played in the Copa America as well in recent years. They played in the Gold Cup. They were actually part of the UEFA qualifying, and they were tagged along with Group A. Their games were played as friendlies, but if you were to factor them in and their results into that entire table, they would have come behind Luxembourg, which I think is sort of a good indicator of maybe where they're at in terms of a level.
I mean, just thinking about Afif, I took a look at him and watched a few clips on him as much as I could. And I suppose, like anything in terms of highlights reel, you obviously get to see the best of them. So he looked like a bit of a world beater when you saw him, but looked into his numbers as well. And he scored 14 goals and had 17 assists in 18 appearances in the Qatari Stars League for Al Sadd, which is posting numbers that makes you think he's far too good for that league in terms of a standard. You maybe then think about the quality of that league, and maybe he is perhaps a little bit too good. But then it was his 14 goals are from an XG of 7.8. So maybe you think about some poor goalkeeping and a bit of luck there as well. So I think if ever they're going to have a strength in attack, it will be through the likes of Afif. But getting the ball to him and, as Michael said, opening the play up will then leave them vulnerable on the counter-attack. Against a higher quality opposition, will Afif look quite as good as well? I don't know. But if it's going to be anyone, I think it'll be through him.
Yeah, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I don't know if you've noticed that
anagram of FIFA.
Yeah, there you go.
Fuming at that, I had a really good line prepped.
Well, so did I until you got all excited about
it. What was yours?
Well, that was going to be it. And then you interrupted me to say what I was going to say. Yeah, I mean, they have changed it, haven't they? So this is going to be the opening game now. Qatar against Ecuador. It was, went back and forth between that and I would say the other more exciting game. I mean, Ecuador, I think it's worth me just reading out their six most recent results. 1-0, 0-0, 1-0, 0-0, 0-0, 0-0. So I don't know if it's going to be a showpiece opener.
Could the FIFA World Cup be a FIFA's World Cup?
Yes.
That's it for part one, but we are not done. Far from it. Make sure that you head back onto the podcast feed and start listening to part two, which begins with Group B, which, as you'll no doubt know, contains England, the USA, Wales and Iran. That episode will end with predicted World Cup winners, a top goal scorer, golden ball winner. Subscribe to this podcast feed. Join us. See you there.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.